Hi, this is Gene Quinn. I'm a patent attorney and the founder of IPWatchdog.com, and you're listening to IP Friday.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Welcome to the 21st episode of IP Fridays. Today we have an interview with Gene Quinn, who is patent attorney in the US, and he's also hosting a famous blog called IP Watchdog. He is a specialist in software patents, and so we are talking about that topic. Also, Ken had the chance to interview Brian Dorn of Barnes & Thornburg. He moderated a discussion with US government representative Eric Paulson about life science and patents. But before we jump into the interviews, I want to say thank you to the Stanford Lawyer website, who mentioned us and our podcast on their website. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So without further ado, here is the interview with Ken and Brian Dorn.
Rolf, I'm joined by Brian Dorn, who is of counsel at Barnes & Thornburg in the Minneapolis office. Brian, you recently moderated an hour-long discussion with United States Representative Eric Paulson, who is also co-chair of the Congressional MedTech Caucus, on the topic of the federal government and the life science industries. Can you summarize your discussion for our listeners?
Yes, thank you. We had a kind of a wide-ranging discussion regarding various topics looking to the upcoming recently started congressional session, the 114th Congress. Mm-hmm. We discussed tax law, looking at the medical device tax repeal. That was rather front and center because Representative Paulson is the chief author on that, and it's one of the higher priorities for the Republican Party in that it's already been introduced. It has 254 co-sponsors, so it will pass the House, has support in the Senate all across the political divide. Senator Hatch's bill, ranging from Ted Cruz in Texas to Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts. So that's something that should be happening quickly. We talked about the effects of corporate inversions, if anything would be done with Congress. We discussed intellectual property. We discussed regulatory law in terms of the 510K program, in terms of medical devices, meningitis B vaccine regulation, trying to get that approved, or what the status of that. Congressman Paulson's a big proponent of trying to speed that up because that vaccine is approved in Canada and Europe, and we still have college students here in the United States dying from meningitis B because one of the reasons the vaccine's not available. And lastly, we also discussed the federal government response to the Ebola situation. I wouldn't call it a health crisis in the United States. It was in Africa, but the federal government response to Ebola this past summer.
Mm-hmm. Since this is an intellectual property podcast, can you speak more specifically to the IP subjects you discussed, like patent reform? What exactly was discussed?
Sure. In regards to the intellectual property, at least according to Representative Paulson, first and foremost is going to be further patent reform legislation to protect U.S. innovation.
And I think if there's one thing the United States does very well, or has had a track record of doing very well on, it's innovation. And if we're going to sustain that innovation in the future, I mean, it's a combination of getting it right on tax reform, immigration reform, you know, patent reform, knowing that patents are part of our DNA, or, you know, innovation is part of our DNA. You know, it's referenced in the U.S. Constitution, literally. And so that's part of who we are.
In terms of the reform and any legislation, the patent troll issue is probably going to take precedence. That's going to be the main issue in any reform in any legislation, and that's really looking at the patent trolls, what people used to call non-practicing entities. And universities really didn't really like that term, so it's a lot of people now call it patent assertion entities. Entities just looking to sue and abuse the kind of the system regarding patent litigation. Anyway, but that should be coming up. There's legislation in the last Congress. Legislation actually passed the House by a partisan vote, but the Senate didn't take any action. Okay. So Representative Paulson did say he's looking for that legislation to go forward again, but it's probably going to be modified. So there's been new developments such as Supreme Court decisions regarding how you can get this get fees and what defines exceptionality. Mm-hmm. Plus, since the Senate has changed parties, there's going to be a new partner, so to speak, or chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So there's probably going to be some reworking of the legislation that way. Mm-hmm. So whatever legislation or bill that was passed will not be the same. There's probably going to be some reworking, and that will probably take some time to shape it. And also in the last Congress, there were multiple bills regarding the legislation besides even the one that passed. But as Representative Paulson said, since one of them was Representative Goodlatte, who is the chair of the Senate or chair of the House Judiciary Committee, that is the one that is most likely to be the basis since he is the chair.
So exciting times indeed at Congress with respect to IP.
Well, somewhat, yes. And someone actually asked the question in terms of patent reform about the balance between life sciences and tech companies, because there is kind of that different interest in patent law. Mm-hmm. Life science companies, it takes so long to get to market and requiring FDA approval and really want really strong patent protection, whereas tech companies are a lot more to the market first and you've been seeing a lot more of the troll issues and all this affecting the tech community rather than life science community. So they have different interests. They have different needs out of the reform. So, and that's one of the things he says that he's really looking for stakeholder groups to weigh in and to really provide pros and cons for each.
Brian, did you discuss any other IP subjects besides patents during the program?
Well, there was one other patent issue that we discussed in terms of more of a biotech specific, in terms of the Myriad decision and patent eligibility of DNA. Mm-hmm. And I had talked about and kind of posited the position that before the Supreme Court decision invalidated it, Congress had kind of taken an implicit approval of it in that they had never outlawed it. In fact, they'd actually passed about a few years before that decision came down from the Supreme Court. They had actually passed legislation that said no human organism is patentable, is not patent eligible. Mm-hmm. So technically under patent law, if you have a recombinant non-naturally occurring organism, it would be patent eligible, and technically, I guess, a human would fall under that. So they took the position that no matter what happened, human organism was not patent eligible. And one of the judges, even in the Federal Circuit decision, kind of adopted that, saying, patent office has been doing it for 30 years, and, there's this implicit approval by Congress. And he didn't necessarily... So my question was with anything coming forth, does Congress want to, so to speak, correct what the Supreme Court has done?
And what was discussed then?
He didn't necessarily take my position of the implicit approval. He didn't say yes or no. He's not aware of anything coming forth from this issue. He said likely a handful of members will take this up at some point. They'll look for feedback on the issue. Most likely, this, if anything comes, it'll be a slow, deliberative process. Any non-patent issues, there's a trade secret legislation that was starting to come around last Congress, and they're looking forward, probably in this Congress, for new trade secret legislation, because currently it's a state issue. 47 states currently have adopted at least some form of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So it's not necessarily uniform. It's mostly the same between the states. There are little differences, but the reason... And I question him, why now? Why are we doing a federal law if we have this in place? And one is, as going back to the importance of IP in this country's economy, wanting to protect the IP, it's better to unify the law instead of having this patchwork of minor differences. Also, the number of hacking incidents and data thefts and that sort of thing is increasing.
Yeah, we've been seeing lots of stories of these in the news in the last 6 to 12 months.
Absolutely. And there, and the, some of the congressional thought is by having a uniform federal trade secret law, that will be helpful in prosecuting any of these hacks or even protecting companies. I mean, some of it's criminal in terms of trying to get, you know, getting money and fraud and all that. But even for the theft of IP, this would come in and fill that role.
2015 just started. Is there any IP legislation that is likely to be enacted this year that you might have touched upon during the program?
Yeah, well, in terms of what we talked about with the patent reform, he said he thought that was likely. It's not going to be an immediate bill. You know, like we talked about the medical device repeal, which has broad support. It's a priority. He's already introduced the legislation. I don't think they've taken a vote. Senator Hatch has introduced the Senate version. That's going to happen. That's going to get to the president's desk very soon. But in terms of the patent reform, like I said, there's going to be some, there's momentum to do it. It's just not going to happen right away because they have to do some of these modifications and various things. With the trade secret bill, that hasn't been introduced yet, but he doesn't think, he was saying, doesn't think that's going to be immediate action. It's likely to happen, but again, it's not immediate. It's going to be a little bit further down the line, but people are looking, that has bipartisan support, and a number of members of Congress are looking to and want to pass something along those lines.
Brian, thanks for sharing your information with us today and our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken and Brian, for this really helpful summary. And if there's one really hot topic in the field of patents nowadays, it's software patents, and there could be no better than Gene Quinn, host of the IP Watchdog and software patent specialist, to talk about this and explain software patents. I'm very excited to be joined by Gene Quinn today. Gene Quinn is also known as the IP Watchdog, probably the most famous or one of the most famous blogs in the IP world. And he is an expert in software patents, and his practice is also focusing on software patents. So I have a couple of questions for him. Thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rolf.
So since you are really an expert on software patents, and many of our listeners might be, you know, working mostly on trademarks and copyright, maybe you can tell us a little bit what makes these software patents special compared to the regular patents.
Well, that's a really good question, and I wish I had a really good answer. And that in and of itself is one of the biggest problems that we have here in the United States, is we really don't necessarily know why these particular patents are different. I can guess at it. I mean, if you look at some of the particularly older software patents that were issued in the U.S., not the oldest ones, but ones that came out after the State Street decision, say like very late 1990s, early 2000s, what you saw was an awful lot of patents that were written like very simple method claims. Method patents, without a discussion of very much of the technology that would be used or necessary in order to pull off the process. So that is, I think, what became offensive. Now, what makes these different long-term or even like today, I really don't know, because if you look at the software patents that are filed today, by and large, they're very thick documents. They have a lot of technical disclosure. And so I don't know what the problem is. The claims, I think, they look at the claims and they say to themselves, the judges say, well, if you read these claims, you wouldn't necessarily be able to write the code or create the computer-implemented process. And, well, that's true, but if you read the entire application, then you would be able to understand what's going on. And the claims have never been in any patent, ever a blueprint. The claims define the scope of what is the exclusive right as it is described in the specification. So I think what makes them different, more so than anything, is a comfort level of familiarity A lot of these judges, for example, on the Supreme Court 18 months ago, Justice Kagan gave an interview to Politico, and she said that they don't even use email. Well, I'm not sure how you can have judges in their 70s and 80s, some of them maybe in their 60s, but certainly senior judges making these technology-based decisions when they don't even use the most basic form of technology available today.
Yeah, so true. And I think if you would give, you know, the full specifications into the hands of programmers, you know, they would immediately know, like, what to do, I would say.
Well, that really, I think, has got to be the test where it ultimately winds up going. And if you look at when David Kapos was director of the patent office and Bilski came out and all this was happening in about 2010, 2011 timeframe, that was what he really instructed the examiners to do back then, was is don't have this be a 101 patent eligibility issue unless it is clearly, in no uncertain terms, not patent eligible. Push through that to get to 112 to see if there is an invention disclosed. Because if there is an invention disclosed, then it really ought to be patent eligible. So how do you know if an invention is disclosed? I think you have to say, could somebody of skill in the art use what you've given us and come up and create what you've described?
Right. So the U.S. Supreme Court has recently issued a few decisions dealing with the patentable subject matter. And the latest in this row is the so-called Alice decision. It seems that the U.S. Supreme Court is taking a very strict view with this decision. How do you interpret this decision?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I think, a very bad decision. I think it is completely inconsistent with many of their other decisions. And that's a problem that the Supreme Court has in the United States. They almost never overrule a prior U.S. Supreme Court decision, but the decisions that they come out with are frequently their decisions. And so therefore reconciling these things becomes very, very difficult. One of the biggest problems with the Alice decision is if you step back and you look at just Alice and Bilski, we have a scenario where under Bilski, they specifically said that business methods are patent eligible. And they said that it is possible that a business method could be patent eligible even if it is not tethered to a machine. Then they go in Alice and they don't ever even use the word software. And they kill these claims that were quite clearly tied to a machine in a particular embodiment under the abstract idea doctrine. And there's just really no logical way to keep these consistent. So the irony is this whole thing started, the whole problem started in the U.S. over the last few years out of a concern over business methods. And today, those are patent eligible, but software maybe is not patent eligible. So there's a lot of ironies. And then if you go back to the 1980s, 81, when the Supreme Court issued their decision in Diamond versus Deere, they quite clearly said software was patent eligible. The whole case was about software. So there's a little bit of a schizophrenic back and forth at the Supreme Court. And I think it's because they don't do enough patent cases to become ever familiar with the substantive area. And two, they are technological novices, extreme novices.
Yeah, as you mentioned, they don't even use email.
Which is boggling. I mean, let me ask you a question. Do you remember a time when email didn't exist?
Well, yes, when I started studying chemistry, that was 1993. I think right. I was one of the first users of email. So,
I remember going to college, and you had to go to the computer lab because you didn't right. have this access in your apartment or dorm room. But I mean, the world has so substantially changed that you really have to think long and hard about the last time you sat down and wrote somebody a letter, maybe a Christmas card or a sympathy card or something like that. But every other form of written communication is now email, business, personal. And these folks don't even use that. And they're deciding. I mean, it boggles the mind.
Right. That's really a little bit far out.
Yeah, I mean, you would almost have to go out of your way to find people who are less technology sophisticated and more poorly equipped to decide these issues than the United States Supreme Court.
Right. So there is a whole new industry that evolved in the last couple of years, the so-called non-practicing entities, or some people call them patent trolls. And do you think the Alice decision will have an impact on the business model of these entities, and particularly the larger ones like Intellectual Ventures or Acacia or Rockstar? And there's also like some of them are more university related. For example, there's the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or, you know, universities that just have a technology transfer office. They also want to have their license fees. So how would they be different?
Well, I do think that there's going to be a dramatic impact. But I don't think it's what most people think is going to be the impact. The impact is not going to harm any of these, or the decision is not going to harm any of the large entities like Intellectual Ventures, Acacia, Rockstar, those types of groups. And to some extent, it may wind up helping them dramatically. Because right now, these assets that relate to computer-implemented methods, whether they have system claims, whether they be just the method claims or computer-readable medium claims, those patents are not worth very much at all right now. And people are trying to sell them, and they're not getting very much money. They're not getting a lot of interest. What I think you're going to see is the birth of super trolls, where you're going to have some well-funded companies that are going to start buying up these patents for pennies on the dollar. And I don't know anybody in the U.S. who thinks that the law as it exists today is going to be the law that we deal with 5 years from now or 10 years from now. May not even be the law we're dealing with over the next year or two. Because if you look at U.S. law as it applies to software and software patents, it has changed dramatically. It's never stayed in one place. I mean, the first software patent was issued back in 1968, and the first time the Supreme Court had an opportunity to kill software patents was in 1972. And then 9 years later, they said in Diamond versus Deere, no, software is patentable. And, you know, so you see every handful of years, this thing has shifted from the very beginning. So if you're got a long view of the patent system and you think that it's going to shift, which I think everybody does, you should be a buyer of these assets right now, because the whole goal of any time you're buying an asset, whether it be a stock or whether it be a patent, you want to buy low and sell high. These things are as low as they're going to go. I mean, so I think you're going to start to see a lot of accumulation. Now, on the university side, I think that this is going to really harm universities. And it's not just Alice, but remember, you mentioned Wharf, which, you know, the Wisconsin folks, and they do a lot of biotech and a lot of genetics there. And you've had myriad decision in the Mayo decision.
Oh, yeah.
On patent eligibility. That will affect them a lot. But even assuming, and Alice will affect them somewhat, but all of these decisions from the Supreme Court are going to negatively affect universities far more, which is horrible, because that's where you get the most basic scientific research going on, because that's their mission. People point and they say, well, they're not very good at technology transfer, or they're not very successful. And it's like, that's right. That's the point. They're doing research that otherwise could not ever be done because it's not economically feasible. So you want them to be engaging in this highly speculative research, but these decisions are going to make it harder for them to get patents. And universities are already very conservative, not in a political way, but in a financial way to begin with, because they have so much innovation going on and so few resources to begin with to move forward. I think you're going to see those kinds of enterprises where they have a lot of innovation and not a lot of resources are going to be very negatively impacted. They're going to be paralyzed.
Right, and I think entities like Intellectual Ventures, they also bought lots of patents that have nothing to do with software. Like, for example, I know a chemistry professor who actually sold a lot of his patents to Intellectual Ventures. So they also have plenty of patents not at all affected by Alice, probably.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And Acacia, I know for sure, is the same kind of deal. And they're starting to get into, from what I've been told, they've always been in this space, but they're putting a lot more emphasis on medical devices than they have maybe in the past. Because a medical device, it's a machine. If machines wind up not being patent eligible, then we might as well just all go home.
Right.
So these companies are starting to move in different spaces. So the problem that we see here in the software area, if it is in fact a problem, we can talk about it. I don't know that it really is nearly the problem that the critics have made it out to be. But to the extent it is a problem, all you're going to do is push these companies into different spaces. And if I could just say for a minute, I don't think that this stuff is a problem. I mean, the people frequently point to smartphones and say, oh my God, patents are awful. We have this patent thicket. The smartphone is being held up. Now just stop and think about that for a second. Exactly what innovation has been stopped in the smartphone area? I mean, every 6 months or to a year, you get the next generation. It's better, stronger, faster, thinner. The battery lasts longer. The glass is harder to break. The apps work better. They do more. Artificial intelligence, voice recognition, you know, control your whole home through your cell phone now. I mean, what innovation has been stopped by patents?
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't, nobody can give me an answer. And I don't think there is any. And I think the story really isn't that Apple won $1 billion from Samsung, you know, and where that winds up, who knows, on appeal and further litigation. But the story isn't that they won $1 billion. The story is they only won $1 billion. I mean, who in their right mind, with as much money as Samsung is making, Samsung should have written the check and said, thank you. I mean, because they're making tens of billions of dollars a year.
Right.
You know, and all the infringement since, you know, however many years, is only worth $1 billion. I mean, I think the same problem we're having in the patent system is one we have in the broader economy, when all, you know, our leaders all over the world have run up such debt that the amount of debt that we owe is so astronomically high and difficult to get our heads around. I mean, $1 trillion, $20 trillion. I mean, it's hard to imagine that amount of money. And I think when you have in these litigations $1 billion, that's a threshold that makes people stand back and say, oh my God, something needs to be done. But just look at how much these companies are worth and how much money they're making.
Right. Yeah. And you just suggested also that the situation might change in the future, you know, buying low and selling high. So do you think the Supreme Court will backpedal in the future, or on the short term at least, will it just be tough to get software related patents granted or enforced in the US?
Well, this is a difficult question to answer. I think a lot of people, what I see is there are a lot of people and companies that are having little to no success getting software patents issued. There are also a lot of companies that are having absolutely no problem getting software patents issued. And I don't know whether it's a political problem. I don't know what exactly the issue is, but I just wrote an article, published it yesterday. The big banks, Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase, they're getting financial service software patents without any problems.
And yeah, I saw that on IP Watchdog.
Yeah, and they're the ones that wanted these patents to go away, you know? So it's hard to understand what's going on at the patent office. There are some people getting them, some people not getting them. I do think you're going to see the law change, though. And I do not, what I can tell clients and people with great certainty today is, if you don't file your application today, you're never going to get get a patent on it. And by the time you ultimately get a final decision, if you don't accelerate the application, it's likely to be 4, 5, 6 years at least. Will the Supreme Court backpedal? I don't know that they'll do it in any relevant quick time, but the history in this space shows that they're schizophrenic and that they do come up with diametrically opposite decisions. So I think that either the Supreme Court is going to backpedal a little at some point, or Congress is going to get involved. And where I think you're starting to see it is up until within, let's say up until about 6 months to a year ago, there was the tech industry was sort of monolithic on this issue. But then Apple, Microsoft, and some others split away from Google and formed the Partnership for American Innovation. And they're talking about how important patents are, how they're needed for innovation. So I think maybe the next time these cases go up to the Supreme Court, if you see the Google side submitting amicus, and then you get IBM, Apple, Microsoft, and all the others on the other side, that maybe then the Supreme Court will stand up and take notice, because it does seem, I agree with the New York Times, they wrote a piece of this maybe now 6 months ago, that explained that the Supreme Court seems to be giving disproportionate attention to amicus briefs. And while they are in an echo chamber, they do seem to really try and keep an eye on the industry in a way that maybe is unhealthy if you're just thinking about the law. So I do see that over time this could change. And just last week, the Federal Circuit came up with a decision. I think it was the right decision, but they found that a software patent claim was patent eligible. So as long as the Federal Circuit keeps making those decisions, you're going to have panel dependency at the Federal Circuit, and the Supreme Court is going to be more and more likely to have to step in. And they, frankly, can't screw up the area any worse than they already have.
All right. So the present situation and the present view of the Supreme Court somewhat resembles the case law in Europe regarding software patents. So do you think the Supreme Court just wanted to work toward harmonization of patent law?
You know, I don't think so. I think that I think Justice Ginsburg is probably the one on the court who is most interested in that and most comfortable looking to Europe and other jurisdictions. But the four conservatives and then the middle of the court, Justice Kennedy, I don't think that they've shown a whole lot of interest in not just this area, but in any area to really try and look at what other countries are doing and feel the need to harmonize the law. So I think that that's more of a happenstance than the court setting out to accomplish that.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I mean, that would be one way to explain what is going on, and it would be logical. And I think I can understand why you would ask that question, because when you see these decisions and you try and line them all up and you look at them and they're really irreconcilable in many ways. So how and why did they come up here? That would be as good a reason as any, I suppose. But I am afraid the reason that they've come where they're at is just because of a lack of an understanding of the issues involved.
Yeah. All right. So will you be at the Meet the Bloggers during the INTA meeting in San Diego in May?
I have it on my calendar.
Now, good.
May and June are just terribly, usually crazy difficult for me, but I try and take any chance I can to get to Southern California. So I'm hoping I'll be able to keep that open and be there. Yes.
Good. I'll be there for certain.
Okay. Good.
So how can our listeners get in touch with you if they wanted to?
Well, the best way is you can go to ipwatchdog.com. That's the best way to get in touch with me there in our contact form, or you can always find me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a good way to shoot me an email. I always monitor those pretty good.
All right. So thanks for being on the show, Gene.
Sure, no problem, Rolf. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.